SDPB Radio. I'm Lori Walsh. You're listening to In the Moment, and welcome to this week's Arts and Lifestyle podcast. We begin by taking a deep breath and picking up a pen. Kaya Ansorge has always loved to write, and now she enjoys inviting others into the practice of mindful writing. She had a weekend workshop at the Prairie West Branch Library in Sioux Falls, and that workshop filled up, but she joined us for an overview. Tell us a little bit about how you first made the connection between a mindfulness practice and a writing practice.
Yes, well, I had always loved writing, or at least I thought I loved writing. Way back when I was a little girl, I would sit up in a tree and, you know, get my cat and my writing things and, my paper and pen. And I would write in this tree, and I felt like I was just crawling into this secret, magical space. But over the years of writing for deadlines, you know, papers and stuff like that we do in public school, though I had many wonderful public school teachers, but as I was writing more and more for deadlines and I would put things off till the end, I started to develop a sort of fear of writing and making it a practice that didn't feel that fun. So even though I thought I loved writing, I was actually stuck. And I couldn't write, and I couldn't write when I wanted to. And so at a point when I was working on my dissertation, this got very serious, and I needed to figure something out. So I was introduced to the idea of stream of consciousness writing. I'd heard about it before, and I'd dabbled with it, but I started really seriously practicing writing every day, writing in a stream of consciousness form, and that transformed into a mindfulness practice. I do have a PhD in religion, so of course I think of things in this particular way. And so I started using it as a mindfulness practice. I slowed it way down, not trying to get things out there, but just trying to crawl into the depths of my soul, my spirit, and find a connection there.
So for people who don't quite understand stream of consciousness writing, because most people don't really do it, because they have to overcome that challenge of, I can't spell.
Yes.
My hand aches a little bit. So tell us exactly what that practice looks like, and then the value that's in it.
So what we really want to do is, you know, calm down, not think about the object that you're writing toward. Instead, start just writing down one word, and it could be anything. You know, you can just say, I don't feel like writing today. It doesn't matter. But usually what we're going to start with is something that's bothering us, something that's stressing us out, so that actually becomes a tool. It's not an end in itself. We're not going to be stuck in the stress. But as we write down one word, another word will come. And so we pay attention to those little prompts within ourselves, and we follow that line of thought. And that's how word after word after word sort of unspools on the paper, and that's how we sort of release into this practice.
Is your goal the writing itself, the process itself, the mindfulness itself, or is your goal the product eventually? This is a doorway that I'm walking through to get to a written piece that, you know, I can submit for a grade deadline or for a publication, or so process or product?
This is very much about process, yes. Good question. In terms of how we live our lives in this culture, as we're always thinking about product, but actually that makes us feel really lonely and really like a tool. We feel like an inanimate object or something that has to be useful. But we're here to live a much deeper life experience than that. And writing is one way. There's lots of mindfulness practices, but there's something about writing that connects first it sort of slows down our mind enough to actually be able to not multitask all the time. It slows down our mind first, but then it hooks us into our heart. And when we go in there, what we're afraid of, the reason we don't do it, this is what stops us so many times, is we think that when we get there, there's going to be nothing there. You know, maybe we'll find damage, maybe we'll find isolation, but really, we might actually find nothingness. It's really big. And so, and of course, and all of our flaws, all of those things are packed in
right
there too. But what we find is totally different. that's what's so surprising. That's what brings me back to it, because mindfulness writing is an adventure. It is not about coming up with something or creating something in that kind of way. It's more about discovery. You're picking your way through the forest of your mind and following that string way down into your heart. And when you get to uncovering it all, you'll be sorting problems along the way and finding solutions. That's super fun, because you think something's really hard and horrible, but it's actually just because that happens to be a block in your life. But to anybody else, it would probably not be that bad. But as you sort of learn objectivity, those things get sorted. But even deeper, you touch what feels like, well, it feels like a wellspring of the infinite. And so you really find a source of power and energy that is undiscoverable by asking other people.
Right. And that is so much more than nothingness.
Yes. It's the opposite.
Do you need, because this is a deeply intimate, you know, process of self, and yet I could imagine somebody listening right now and saying, well, what if things come up? What if garbage comes up? What if trauma comes up in this process of mindful writing? Should I have someone on deck in my life to talk to about that, or do I just come back to the page?
Well, it's always a good idea to, our minds are very complex, and they like to be entertained, and they like to have multiple ways of growing and healing and exploring. So it's never wrong to go at our difficulties from multiple directions, whether it's through counseling, through family support, but lots of us don't have that. And we might not even have the money for counseling. So one thing that's really nice about writing is that it is available to anyone who can afford some paper and a pen. And that's actually fairly affordable in our culture. And so what I find is that discovering the answer for yourself is much more rewarding than someone else telling you the answer for you. We don't always hear it. I mean, how many times have you or I or someone given advice, and then we look over at that person and we're like, they didn't take our advice. So they could have made their life much easier, you know, with our big, you know, on our high horse. Yeah. But we actually have to discover it for ourselves. That's part of what we're here to do. This is why we're living a life.
And for people who listen to words like mindfulness and meditation, and they have a hesitation in that direction because it feels slow and it feels, it feels like it takes more patience than they have or more time than they have. Is writing mindfully sort of a way into those kind of practices? Is it meditation, or are these two separate things?
It very much can be meditation. Often we don't use it that way. We use writing for many things. One of the problems is we often write on our computers, which is exactly right. The place where we have been regularly training our brain to think in fragmented ways. Mm. And so I recommend that people, when they're first starting out writing, do go back to the paper and the pen, and turn off the internet, get away from it, get somewhere quiet. And that might not be in your home, because lots of times we have tasks in our home that need doing. So it might be the library. That's a great place. But it's also, it could be a coffee shop. It's anywhere that you wouldn't feel pulled on by other people.
Yeah.
And when you go into that, it definitely can be a form of meditation. But what I also find is that it's actually a quick route to finding out what we really need to do in our life, and we become more efficient. By becoming less efficient for a few minutes, we actually become more efficient, because we know what to say no to, and we have the strength and the fortitude to say that no. And we also know when to speak up, and it's the most efficient way to truly find out when we need to speak up and when which battles do we need to pick, that kind of thing, right? So we have lots of issues in our life. Some of them we all react differently. Some of us feel sad or more often, or we feel angry more often. But all of those feelings are more deeply rooted within us, and to find the tendrils of that and to really know which ones count the most.
Bill Grothy will soon take his place in the South Dakota Hall of Fame for his work in historical photography. His images include the construction of Mount Rushmore and notable Native Americans like Nicholas Black Elk. The photographer sometimes didn't get paid to document events and people, but he did make a living with commercial photography and film processing. Grothy tells SDPB's China Lockett about the moments that caught his lens.
When Bill Grothy was 10 years old, he saw a camera in a store window for a dollar and bought it. When he went to buy film, something happened that would change his life in the form of an apprenticeship at a local studio.
And so I got started there in 1935 and just learning, working after school, helping as I could.
Grothy soon started taking his own photos and learned portrait photography. Many of his images ended up on postcards and sold for 2 cents a piece, enough, he says, to keep the business afloat. He was a teenager when workers started to build Mount Rushmore. The studio managers began to document the project.
I was lucky because I worked in a studio. I wasn't getting paid, but I got to go along and go up in the cable car and help carry part of the equipment. 13, 14, 15, 16, all of those years at Rushmore.
Grothy says he didn't think too much about the historical impact of Mount Rushmore while he was there. It was a job to keep the business going.
We didn't make a postcard negative of just some flower with a B on it. It was something that had to sell again and again. So it was a historical event.
In the 1920s and 30s, segregation was commonplace in the U.S. Government-run boarding schools took Native American children from their families in South Dakota and taught them English. That was when Grothy was taking pictures of weddings, events, and Native American dancers. Grothy isn't Native, but says he wasn't raised to discriminate.
Well, my closest friend, well, they were Native. It didn't make any difference to me. We were all just kids. We're all pretty poor. And we'd hitchhike to the lake and spend the day and compete against one another. I had no reason to even think about it. Of course, I had marvelous parents that never had any bias whatsoever.
He brought that sense of equity into his work. Grothy photographed portraits of Native American leaders to document their accomplishments. He says many of his subjects already knew him from photographing dances, so they let Grothy pose them. One of his most famous pieces is a portrait of the Lakota holy man, Nicholas Black Elk.
But I knew these people, and I respected them, so they respected me.
Grothy also took a famous image of the last reunion of the 8 survivors of the 1876 Battle of Little Bighorn.
At that event, I only had 36 sheets of film, and I got 32 different images that are published. So I only shot one shot of each of those portraits.
He was the only photographer who showed up to document the reunion.
All of the time that I photographed these gentlemen, we didn't talk about battles, understand? The battles had been over for 70 years or more.
Grothy says those images are valuable because there's only one negative of each shot, and he has those negatives. In 1943, Grothy joined the Army Air Corps. His background made him a natural for something called photomapping. He took images of enemy territory with a camera from a moving plane.
But as things changed, the big planes were being shot down. A photo was what had to come in low and try to get the pictures, but they get shot down, they're too slow.
Then, Grothy worked with new miniature cameras mounted on the planes. He'd operate them remotely and develop those images in a darkroom. When he returned from war, he went back to the Rapid City studio. Grothy says he went a full 12 years without a vacation. He met his wife of 66 years, Alice, when he finally took a skiing trip. In the 1950s, they owned and operated their own business, developing film and doing commercial photography. Grothy says as the market has adjusted to digital photography, he stuck to film.
I still do what I do, and I'm just an old photographer, so what's the difference?
Grothy and his wife have 2 children, 7 grandchildren, and 2 great-grandchildren. They're Grothy's priority.
I just want my kids to make it and be happy. I don't have any goals for legacy. I never thought about it. I never thought of quitting and retiring. And so they'll probably find me in the dark room someday. I don't know.
Great. 95-year-old Grothy still moves around the shop, now on a cane, selling customers prints from the past and developing their film. He plans to keep his business running as long as he can. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Chyna Lockett in Rapid City.
SD Nelson and Gregory Bryan journeyed to Brookings for a talk at the South Dakota Art Museum. It was for a closing reception of exhibits that have highlighted Nelson's work and work of artist and illustrator Paul Goebel. Nelson's exhibit is the first time the Lakota artist's works have been displayed at the South Dakota Art Museum. Bryan is the renowned biographer of Paul Goebel. Gregory Bryan, welcome back to In the Moment. Thanks for being here again with us.
Thank you, Laurie. It's wonderful to speak with you again.
And SD Nelson, it's a pleasure to have you here for what I believe is the first time. I don't think you and I have ever spoken, at least.
Well, I haven't spoken with you before, Laurie, but I, of course, have been to Brookings for the book festival that is held biannually. And I have to tell you, I'm from Arizona. I'm quite surprised at all this rain. And fortunately, I got in to Sioux Falls the day after the tornado.
Wow.
But it's good to be here.
There were a lot of people who were in the air when that weather was coming through and had some dicey travel time. So we're very glad that you made it.
Yeah.
I want to start with you, SD Nelson, and tell us a little bit about this exhibition, and for many people, they largely know you for the illustrations and the work that you do in the children's market. And this is some of that and also an expansion of that. Tell us a little bit about this particular exhibition.
Well, they have approximately 14, 15 of my original pieces that are on display. And I just got to see that this morning for the first time. And it's quite wonderful to be in the same gallery with Paul Goebel and someone like Harvey Dunn, who, if your listeners don't know, is from South Dakota and was one of the premier illustrators during the golden age of illustration. The works that the museum does have of mine on display are Native American in subject matter, Lakota, and my inspiration for these pieces is my childhood, really, spent in Dakota. I would spend part of my summers on the Standing Rock Reservation, staying with my grandmother, and I hope that comes through in the artwork.
Did you have sort of contact with Paul Goebel as an artist at all? Do you remember seeing his work?
Definitely. Paul Goebel has had quite an influence on my art career. I remember reading his Caldecott-winning book, The Girl Who Loved Wild Horses, many years ago, and his work, frankly, is just quite visually spectacular, and he has a true sensitivity to Lakota ways. And so I immediately felt a connection with his work visually and in his writing, and it has inspired me to myself become an author and illustrator.
And Greg Bryan, you have an interesting story about how you sort of became Paul Goebel's biographer. Tell us a little bit about some of those connections that you were able to make before the artist died.
Yeah, well, it's actually it's one of those things. Paul's wife, Janet, used to say that the stars just aligned, and I think there's some truth in that. It was rather fortuitous. The first time I met Paul was also the first time that SD Nelson met Paul. SD Nelson and Paul were both presenting at a conference in Rapid City, and I was in Winnipeg at the University of Manitoba and looking for some interesting presentations at various conferences, and I saw that Paul Gober was going to be presenting, and so I applied to attend that conference, and that's when I was able to meet Paul. And just out of interest, I asked him if it would be okay if I tape recorded his presentation, because I thought that my university students would be interested in hearing the things that he had to say. And Paul said that he was happy with that, so long as I provided him with a copy of the recording as well, because he wanted to pass it on to his grandchildren. And so I did that, and I sent it to Paul, and then as some sort of a thank you, he sent me the book that he had just finished, that had just been published, and from that experience began a correspondence, which eventually led me to to asking him if he would be interested in a biography about his life. Now, one of the things that I heard Paul, in fact, probably the thing that I heard Paul say more often than anything else was, "Greg, nobody will be interested," but I certainly assured him that he was wrong, because I knew that at least one person was interested, and that was me, and I knew that others would be as well. And so from those sort of rather humble beginnings, a really strong friendship blossomed, and it was a great delight to be able to become a friend of Paul's and to work so closely with him on compiling his biography. And he certainly was mindful of the very kind things that S.D. Nelson said about him and about the influence that Paul's work had had on S.D. Nelson's career. And he was always very appreciative of that kind support.
Mm. And S.D. Nelson, you must have some awareness of the number of young children, teachers, other artists who are trying to make their way in the world, who come across your art and see that same kind of inspiration. Tell me a little bit about what your hopes are as an artist. Do you think about that? Do you think about inviting others into the world of art and into the world of telling their own stories of their own lives and their own viewpoints?
That is a wonderful question. I was hoping you would ask something along those lines. Yes, the audience that I imagine I'm painting for and writing for are Native American children, and of course the general public, but my primary intention, as I'm actually sitting and writing and painting at my easel, my primary intention is to reach out to Native American children and let them know that they are living in the moment. This is the present, and they have an energy to live this life and become connected and do things, make things, whether it's in writing or illustrating books, whether it's playing sports or becoming a radio broadcaster. I just really want to reach out to children and share some of the heritage and history of our people.
Your art is, I'm not an expert in art, so maybe Greg Bryan can tell me how to describe it a little bit, but every time I see something by S.D. Nelson, I recognize it. It's lush, it's beautiful, it just takes you to another place immediately. Tell me how you sort of develop your style. How have you grown as an artist over the years?
Is that a question for me?
It is.
Oh, that means I have to answer it. Well, there have been many things that have influenced me. When I was a boy, I was raised in a military family, so we lived in many different places. And including living 3 years in Germany during the Cold War back in the 1950s. But whenever we had the opportunity, we would return to my mother's home on the Standing Rock Reservation. And I got to spend about 2 weeks every summer with my grandmother, who she lived in a log cabin, and I got to stay there. She had no running water. We had an outhouse out back. It was a very rustic lifestyle, and those Indian ways just became a part of me, because we, in a military family, moved about an awful lot, and Dakota became my home in my heart. And so for whatever reason, as a boy, I started drawing and painting and making models, and ended up going to the university in Moorhead, Minnesota, Minnesota State University, where I studied art. And one thing led to another, and thank you for the kind words about my artwork.
And the stories that you tell, sticking with you, S.D. Nelson, for just a moment, but are also the stories of their Lakota stories. There are people that you feature, you know, Sitting Bull and Red Cloud and others, really cementing some of those stories in a way that come from a place of authenticity. As well. So even though many Lakota children or Native American children are going to interact with your children's books, for a lot of other people, that might be the only time they hear the story of Red Cloud at all, which is sort of a big responsibility in some ways.
Yes. Yes. Well, I'm glad you mentioned the word authenticity. I have been blessed in many ways, and I can remember back in 1971, I had a summer job on the Standing Rock at the community of Wakpala in South Dakota. And just up the road from there is where Sitting Bull had his cabin on the Grand River. And I got to spend the summer there, and I got to see the stars of night, the aurora borealis. I really fell in love with the prairie that particular summer. And I knew that Sitting Bull had ridden his horse and traveled right through the area where I was, and it left a strong impression upon me. And I hope that the studies that I've done, reading books and listening to the words of people like Joseph Marshall and Sun Dancers that I have spent a lot of time with, I hope that authenticity comes through in my storytelling. Mm-hmm.
So we're talking with S.D. Nelson and Gregory Bryan, the men behind two South Dakota Art Museum exhibits of American Indian story illustrations, and they're speaking September 12th, that's today, 5:45 p.m. during the 5 to 7 p.m. closing reception. The two exhibitions are called S.D. Nelson, Sharing My Vision, and A Life's Work, Paul Goebel, Illustrations of American Indian Story. There's a book signing from 4 to 5 and a free reception, and I think they're speaking 5:45 to 6:30 or so. Greg Bryan, what's next for you? This book has really been popular. When we did, I think we did a 45-minute interview with you about the book when it first came out, and it was hugely popular on our website with people downloading it and listening to it. Book is doing well. Where do you go from here?
Well, I've got a few projects in the works. Certainly one of the projects is an additional book about Paul Goebel, focusing more on his art, more so than his life, and that one is tentatively titled Paul Goebel Artist, as opposed to the first book, which was called Paul Goebel Storyteller. And that has been submitted to the publisher, and they provided very helpful feedback for me, but I've been busy with a few different things and haven't yet got back to addressing that feedback, but I'm hoping that in the near future that will finally be ready to go off to the publisher again for reconsideration. I've also been working on a children's literature textbook, and S.D. Nelson very kindly allowed us to use one of his wonderful paintings as the cover image, so I'm sure that will be enticing. So those sorts of things are keeping me busy, but all of the projects that I work on and the people that I get to work on them with, like Paul Goebel and like S.D. Nelson, the types of projects that I absolutely love. And so I'm very fortunate to have the opportunities that I have. And I recognize the same sort of attitude in S.D. Nelson as he talks about his history and heritage. And in that sort of thing, he's very similar to Paul Goebel as well, a very humble man and, of course, marvelously talented artists. And there's lots of similarities about their art styles because, of course, they were both very heavily influenced by traditional ledger book art. And so that's evident in connecting the two artists, but then they each took it in their own direction and added their own individual flair. You described earlier SD's work as, I think you said, lush and beautiful, and it certainly is that. And it's a wonderful tribute, not just to their own talents, to Paul's and S.D. Nelson's own talents, but also a wonderful tribute to the Indigenous artists who preceded them working with ledger books back in, say, the 1890s and thereabouts.
This week's Moment in Sound featured Jeff Gunderson. He's been a fixture of the Sioux Falls music scene for close to four decades, a member of the popular rock band Wakefield, and more recently with Jukebox Zeros. Jeff plays a wide variety of music as a solo artist. He released his latest album, Half Life, just last month, and we were honored to welcome to the Leo P. Flynn Gallery. Four decades. A lot has changed in the Sioux Falls music scene, in the South Dakota music scene in four decades. Tell me a little bit about how you have watched that evolve and how you have evolved with it.
Well, it's actually been over four decades. I started playing professionally, in a sense, when I was about 14 years old, and I'm going to be 60 this year. So, yeah, it's changed quite a bit. Live music was a destination when I first started playing. When I traveled with Wakefield, we played around 250 nights a year for quite a few years in a row. And we would be out in the middle of South Dakota somewhere, and people would travel from miles around to see live music. It's a little different now because there's so many options and with all the digital social media.
Right.
But yeah, it was a fun time.
Yeah,
back then.
And you make your living doing this. There was a time where you said it's okay to quit my day job now, and that's been a great decision for you. Take me back to that those moments where you thought, can I really be in music as a full time artist?
Well, in the 80s, I was. We pulled a salary of $200 a week, and which was enough to scrape by back then. But I got out of that and finished a business degree at USD, became a full-time health insurance underwriter for over 15 years. And then when my kids, I guess to provide a stable home environment for them, and when they were on their own is when I looked into teaching full-time, teaching kids, and I started a program, the Child Bloom Guitar Program. It's actually in its 10th year this year. Of Sioux Falls.
Yeah.
There's a national program that's been around since 1980 is when it started. But I started the Sioux Falls program 10 years ago, 2009, and haven't looked back. It's been great. And I of course, perform a lot, played with the Jukebox Zeros for quite a few of those years. Now I'm mostly doing solo stuff. Tonight I have a big band gig with Kick and Brass we play. So I do a lot of different things. I kind of have to, I guess, hustle a bit and play where I can, but it's been fun.
Yeah. So. Well, we're going to get to some of those dates where people can see you and connect with you in just a minute, but let's start with some music. What will you play for us first?
I think I'll start with, this is a song called I Can't Imagine a World Without You. I actually wrote this while I was an underwriter on the road on a business trip, so it sounds like it could be on the road as a musician too, but as I can't imagine.
late night, can't sleep. Out on the road, watching one more movie, another episode. You're home waiting so patiently, 'cause I go crazy when you're not with me. You bring meaning to my song. You're the right way to my wrong. And somehow I can't imagine a world without you. It all seems so pointless, all alone. I'm just wasting, wishing I was home. You're my water when I'm dry. You're the star in my dark sky. And somehow I can't imagine a world without you. Without you, the colors fade away. It's night without a day. There's nothing more to say. Daylight driving, 300 miles to go. Can't find one good thing on the radio. Time moves slowly, but that's all right, 'cause I know I'll be with you tonight. You bring meaning to my song. You're the right way to my wrong. And somehow I can't picture me without you. Somehow I can't imagine a world without you.
Jeff Gunderson on today's Moment in Sound. We're broadcasting live from the Leo P. Flynn Gallery in SDPB's Sioux Falls studio. Tell us about the new album and the sort of decision to take some of these songs and share them for the first time, really, in this format.
Yeah, well, a lot of these songs, most of them actually written quite a while ago, over the past almost 40 years. And a lot of them I had never really shared with a lot of people. I didn't play them a lot live. There are songs I had written. There's one that I wrote for my wife on her 10th anniversary. There's a song I wrote for my first daughter when she was born, Jessica. There's a song I wrote for my second daughter when she was about 5 years old. I wrote that one. There's an instrumental that I wrote for our first granddaughter who passed away at childbirth. So that's an instrumental that I have with a cellist in town here. Karen Millick Stepanoff played on that. In the recording. So these songs I had written, and I recorded a lot of them kind of in my basement about 10 years ago, or over 10 years ago, 2001 or so. And I was listening to them again and just thought, you know, I should do it right. So I called Mike Dresch, Cat House Studios, and he does an awesome job. He's recorded tons of local artists and national artists. And I started recording, I believe, back in September of last year. So it was almost a year. I finally got it out August 26th, which is my anniversary, so our anniversary, I should say. And yeah, it's been fun.
Yeah. Where can people get the album, get the CD?
Right now, it's available at my website. It's available, which is jeffgunderson.com. You got to spell Jeff, right? It's G-E-O-F-F, G-U-N-D-E-R-S-O-N, and it's also distributed by CD Baby, so it's on cdbaby.com, and they put it out everywhere, so Spotify, Amazon, iTunes, all those places, yeah. You can download it. So
And we'll put a link to his website up on our website after the program at listen.sdpb.org, so you can find Jeff Gunderson.com pretty easily. What's next? Play for us again, please.
Sure. This is the song I wrote for my daughter Marissa when she was about 5 years old. This song was actually a little behind this song. This has been, you know, these songs I write kind of are with them for their whole life. And her fiancé actually proposed to her with a recording of this song.
Oh, wow.
and of course, this was our father-daughter dance at her wedding. Yeah. And I actually talk about her getting married in this song, which she... which came true, of course. So this is called When Marissa Smiles. She's got a hair and a pony with a red rubber band and her sister's old blue jeans. Her socks are on, but she still can't find her shoes. Knock down, drag out, tooth and nail, it's just another day. Hurry up now, we don't have time to lose. When she smiles, the clouds all fade away. When she smiles, the sun comes out to play. When she smiles, I can see tomorrow, make it through today. It makes it all worthwhile when Marissa smiles. Swimming pools and Sunday schools and picnics in the park. Hurry up now, off to bed she goes. Higher than the sky and deeper than the sea and bigger than the universe. How I love her, she will never know. When she smiles, the clouds all fade away. When she smiles, the sun comes out to play. When she smiles, I can see tomorrow, make it through today. It makes it all worthwhile when Marissa smiles. Oh, time passes on, no matter how we wish it to stand still. Oh, we all carry on, we keep on keeping on against our will. She's got her hair done up with flowers and a brand new wedding dress as she makes her way slowly down the aisle. With breaking heart I let her go, a tear forms in my eyes. When she turns her head, she looks at me and smiles. When she smiles, the clouds all fade away. When she smiles, the sun comes out to play. When she smiles, I can see tomorrow, make it through today. It makes it all worthwhile when Marissa smiles. It makes it all worthwhile when Marissa smiles.
Our guest is Jeff Gunderson right now, and there could not have been a dry eye at that wedding when that song played and you danced. Yeah. There's a lot of love and emotion in that. How does that kind of affect your family then, sort of growing up with, I mean, you're playing in the living room for them the first
great.
Time, you
Music's
know?
Music's a huge part of our yeah. family. When we get together, I always pull my guitar out I have grandkids now, so they love it, you know, and they know they're my biggest fans. You know, they play the album a lot, and they know which one's their mommy's song and Edith's song and everything. So it's a lot of fun.
Yeah. And they know how to rock out because the album, you know.
Oh, yeah, there's some rockers on there, too. Yeah. I get asked that a lot because a lot of people know me from Wakefield
right. And
electric guitar, and usually when I do my solo, it's just acoustic. So are you playing electric on it? So, yes,
there's, you are. Yeah.
There's some rockers on there, too. There's a very diverse bunch of songs on there. There's everywhere from funk to kind of classical to a little more bluesy, and I play some harmonica on it. I even play a little sitar on one song, so...
And you mentioned Child Bloom, and I have sort of seen these classes take place with these tiny little kids kind of learning how to play guitar. Tell me a little bit about how you get someone started at a young age in music. How do you kind of keep them interested and keep it fun for them and yet teach them something?
Yeah, well, I love teaching kids, and if it's the correct curriculum, they really absorb it. They're, you know, just like sponges, and they learn to read music really well, better than usually my adult students, because that's a challenge. But the kids just pick it up really easily, and there's certain techniques that are used specifically designed for kids. You know, there's not a big emphasis right away on music theory, and learning the hows and whys behind it all. We just play and have fun. We play melodically, so we don't strum chords, we play one note at a time.
Right.
And so they learn songs with melodies, which they connect to a lot better. And chords are tough for kids. You know, sometimes the parents want them to learn to strum right away. And we do definitely get into chords at some point when they want to do it. So they guide it a lot, and a lot of performing. So the tomorrow afternoon, I'm having my 7th annual all-student recital. So I've got 50-some kids on stage at one time, you know, playing Hot Cross Buns and songs like that. And then we move on to the more advanced students, too. So there's something for everybody there. Mm. But that's a lot of fun. It's kind of a controlled chaos, but, that'll be fun.
What's the difference between classical and fingerstyle guitar? Can you describe that?
Well, classical is fingerstyle guitar.
Okay.
The guitar used generally is a nylon string guitar, and which is more designed for fingerstyle guitar. Technique is really important. It's designed, you want to hold it a certain way, and the reason for that is to just for maximum efficiency and minimum possibility of injuries. It allows you to achieve the maximum potential, so you'll learn to play with the fingers in a position so you can reach all the frets and play all the strings. And of course, the repertoire goes back hundreds of years. We play songs from Spanish tunes that were in the almost 1500s. And so there's history to it, too.
So what was the instrument like back then? How are the instruments different?
To
where some of that music can actually survive and translate.
The music really connects to the kids. So if Gaspar Sanz was back in the medieval period, and there's songs by him in the curriculum, as well as more current songs that were written by contemporary composers too. So, it's just fun stuff. There's some blues in the curriculum that we play. So there's some just, you know, what you'd probably call a fingerstyle guitar, not necessarily classical, but a lot of it is the guitar itself and the technique that's used to play it. So,
all right, play something for us again, please. What's next?
Okay, well, I'll do. this is early for my voice, I guess. Probably a little nervous too. So, this one is down in a lower range. This is most of the song is pretty positive. I try to write uplifting songs that make you feel good. But this is one I wrote when I was kind of in a rut with my job, called Going Through the Motions. So maybe you can relate to that one. Another Monday morning routine blues. Waking up to the 6 a.m. news. Stimulus response, follow your cues. You're going through the motions,
You're acting out a scene, a minor role in someone else's dream. Stay awake now, thing, don't blow your lines. Just do as you're told and you'll be fine. Keep things in perspective, don't lose your self-control. You're just an actor putting in your time. Going through the motions, you're acting out a scene, a minor role in someone else's dream. Going through the motions, you're acting out a scene, a minor role in someone else's dream. The shackles come undone. You make it home before the setting sun. Wife, two kids, two cars, two-star garage. It's time to settle back in your mirage. Going through the motions, you're acting out a scene, a minor role in someone else's dream. Going through the motions, you're acting out a scene, a minor role in someone else's dream.
Jeff Gunderson on today's Moment in Sound, and you can see him later today. You're headed to Dalrymple, and then tonight at the with Kick and Brass at 7:30. That's at the El Rayed.
El Rayed Shrine. I'm just going to be kind of hanging in the background, playing rhythm on that one. But it's a fun gig, yeah.
And then tomorrow at the R Wine Bar.
That I'll be playing a lot of my originals and just some fun stuff. So.
And then next Friday and Saturday, Paramount Studio.
At Paramount, yeah.
You're a busy man.
You've done your research. Yeah, well, it has to be. Yeah, Paramount's a fun place, too. So.
Yeah, that's a good place to listen to live music.
Yeah.
You also have played with Swan Song and played for people in hospice. So little tiny kids, teaching them to love music and then helping people exit.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know, transition to the next place, however you want to call
that,
through hospice.
Yeah. No, I play, like this afternoon, I play at Dalrymple, and I love doing that. That's very rewarding, and they're really a great audience. I had an epiphany. If you're in your 80s today, you're in your 20s and the 60s,
right?
Which is the music I grew up on. So
yeah. Perfect.
And they're singing along, so it's fun stuff.
Will you play one more for us before we let you go?
Let's see. I'll play the song I wrote for my first baby, Jessica. This was written back in 1983, just a couple days after she was born. So she was just a little baby. So this is a nice short song. This, she surprised me at her wedding. She played this, she inserted this into our father-daughter dance without me knowing about it. She found a recording of it, so... this is called Jessica. And one more thing. This is a short little song, and I thought about adding verses at some point because it's just pretty short. But it just seemed like it captured a moment in time. So which is in the moment, yeah. But so it never seemed right to add anything to it. But on the recording, I have the Augustana String Quartet, led by Peter Folliard, play on the song. So you'll have to imagine that. So this is called Jessica.
Jessica, how long I've waited for you, Jessica. My mind is made up for you, here you come. Your life is just beginning, here you come. I say hello by singing Jessica, Jessica, Jessica. Jessica, a tiny piece of heaven, Jessica. Just listen, birds are calling out your name. The universe is trying to proclaim. The world is waiting for you, Jessica, Jessica, Jessica.
And now, what's in a name? Here's Patrick Hicks with this week's episode of Poetry from Studio 47.
This is Poetry from Studio 47. Welcome. Today's poet is Charles Harper Webb. Webb was born in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, in 1938, and he was raised in Houston, Texas. After finishing high school, he received his B.A. from Rice University, also in Houston. He went on to receive his M.A. in English from the University of Washington. This was followed by an M.F.A. and Ph.D. from the University of Southern California. A trained psychotherapist, Webb is also a guitarist and a singer. His books include Reading the Water, Hot Popsicles, Shadow Ball, What Things Are Made Of, Brain Camp, and A Million M.F.A.s Are Not Enough, among many others. During his career, he has won a Whiting Award, a Guggenheim, the Kate Tufts Discovery Prize, and an Academy of American Poets Prize. He teaches at California State University, Long Beach. Today's poem is titled Charles Harper Webb. What I really love about this poem is the topic. We're all fine-tuned to the frequency of our own names. Whenever I hear the word Patrick, I'm immediately looking around, and even if it's another Patrick that has been asked for, I feel a little kinship with this person. I can't be the only person on the planet who has Googled his name and looked at the other Patrick Hickses out there. I did this just the other day and found out that one is a college baseball player, another a massage therapist, one is a lawyer, another a criminal, one does IT, and another does graphic design. We're all strangers, but we have one thing in common. Whenever we hear our name, we turn our head. Charles Harper Webb breaks down his first, middle, and last name. He imagines their sounds, their histories. He also imagines how these names impact how he sees the world and how the world sees him. This is Charles Harper Webb by Charles Harper Webb. Manly, my mother said my first name meant. I enjoyed sharing it with kings, but had nightmares about black-hooded axemen lifting bloody heads. I loved the concept of Charlemagne and inked it on my baseball glove and basketball. I learned that females pronounce Charles easily. Males rebel. Their faces twitch, turn red as stutterers. Finally, they spit out Charlie or Chuck. Charles is a butler's name, or a hairdresser's, they explain. I'll bet Charles Manson would straighten those guys' tails. I'll bet he fixed their hair just right. My name contains its own plural, its own possessive. Unlike Bob or Bill or Jim, it won't just rhyme with anything. I told Miss Pratt, my eighth grade French teacher, Charles sounds like a wimp. I switched to German to be Carl. Of all possible speech, I hear Charles best. I pluck it from the sea of noise the way an osprey plucks a fish. In print, it leaps out before even sex words do. My ears twitch, eager as a dog's. What sweet terror in the sound. Is Charles there? Oh, Charles! Oh, Charles. Oh, Charles. Charles, see me after class. Get in this house, Charles Harper Webb. Harper, nag, angel, medieval musician, web, from the Middle English viba, weaver, as in the web of my least favorite crawling thing. My pale ancestors, stoop-shouldered, with sneezing allergies, stupefied by the loom's endless clack, 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 squatting in the dirt-floored cottages year after year, poking out every decade or so to see brawny men in armor gallop past, followed by the purple passage of a king.
Poetry from Studio 47 is hosted and curated by Patrick Hicks. All poems used with permission, recorded at Augustana University, and produced by Peter Folliard. Thank you for listening.
That's your update for the week. We hope that it served you. If you're looking for individual segments from our radio program, well, you can find them all online at listen.sdpb.org, or you can subscribe to the In the Moments Segments podcast, where you get each conversation individually broken down from 9 to 10 hours of weekly In the Moment live radio. The In the Moment podcast is produced by Josh Heyer. You can follow me on Twitter at MomentSDPB. Do you have a story idea? Send an email to inthemoment@sdpb.org. For Josh Heyer, Chris Loffrey, Steve Zwemke, I'm Lori Walsh. Thank you for listening.